From the Sky Centre at 6, a 34-year-old man has been found guilty of a series of abductions and rapes against 11 women and children. It's emerged Joseph McCann had been mistakenly released from prison just 2 months before he carried out the attacks in the spring. Detective Chief Inspector Catherine Goodwin from the Met Police says he's the most dangerous sex offender she's come across.
I can't even begin to imagine how they were feeling whilst they were detained, some of them for up to 14 hours. Whilst they were being threatened, whilst their loved ones were being threatened, whilst they must have genuinely been in fear for their lives.
An autistic teenager who threw a six-year-old boy from a viewing platform at the Tate Modern told police he wanted to be on the news. Jonty Bravery, who has pleaded guilty to attempted murder, says he wanted to highlight how unhappy he was with his mental health treatment. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn will go head-to-head in a live TV debate later. It's likely they will clash on the Prime Minister's Brexit deal. A couple who were rejected by their local adoption service because of their Indian heritage have won their legal discrimination battle. Sandeep and Reena Mander from Berkshire have been awarded nearly £120,000 in damages. Their lawyer, Georgina Calvert-Lee, says they are delighted.
The Manders are British. They believe in British values of fairness and equality, and so they brought this case to establish that they had a right to be treated like every other British person on an equal footing. And the Manders can only hope prospective adoptive parents are not treated in the way they were.
Eddie Stabar has been saved after being sold to a private equity company. The haulage firm has been on the brink of collapse as it struggles with debts of £200 million. And in sport, Chelsea have hit back at FIFA after successfully appealing to have their transfer ban reduced. They say they've been treated entirely differently to Manchester City, who weren't punished as severely for breaching rules relating to signing young players. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is the Green Party's candidate to become Mayor of Bristol next May, Sandy Hall-Ruthven. And Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast news at 7, Trudeau cocking a snook at Trump. Yes, it must be NATO's 70th birthday bash in London. But when these NATO leaders put their heads together, are they really concerned for our defence or starting the next war? Will it be a small war? Like turning Libya over to the law of the jungle? Or a big war? As tensions simmer between politically deadlocked Israel and Iran, not a lot of talk in the general election campaign about whether party leaders would support another US-led war in the Middle East. We talk tonight about Tony Blair and George Bush's Iraq war. How and why that war was illegal. And why neither have faced prosecution for the same offences that sent Nazis to the gallows. And one man who was sentenced at Nuremberg in absentia, Hitler's private secretary, Nazi Party treasurer Martin Bormann. For those enjoying our digging dirt on Hitler's Reichsleiter, secretly rescued from Berlin by Ian Fleming and the Royal Navy, more evidence on Hitler's obsequious private secretary who stayed in the shadows. A fortnight ago, we heard how he organised the Wannsee Conference on the Final Solution, where Heydrich and Eichmann approved their Final Solution programme on the Jewish question, yet never actually attended in person. This week, the funds Bormann managed and the bribes paid to the Gauleiters and concentration camp commandants to keep them all sweet, and how, incredibly, May the 1st, 1945 Ian Fleming rescue tale dovetails nicely with the official story. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. Tonight lows around 7 Celsius, light rain and breezy. This weekend highs around 10. light cloud tomorrow, and strong winds and light rain on Sunday. Next week, highs around 11, some sunshine and some rain, and windy at times. Next weekend, the 14th and 15th of December, highs around 10 Celsius, sunshine again and light rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining us to review this week's news is the Green Party's candidate to become Mayor of Bristol next May, Sandy Hoare-Ruthven. Hi, Sandy, and welcome again.
Good evening.
What is the Green Party's pitch for this general election, particularly on climate change? Because I know that there's something particularly that came out this week all about the environment.
So the Green Party has pledged £100 billion towards going carbon neutral by 2030. So that's everything from insulating homes to investments in renewable energy, decarbonising.
Is the Green Party going to buy me a new car then? Because my car's not carbon neutral.
So the details would be worked out. But what it means is that there would be subsidy for purchasing electric cars. But actually, more importantly for that than that is changing how our cities operate. So investing in more cycle lanes, better buses, improved walking routes, that means it's easier to get around the city and gives people a real choice to travel in a different way.
What about public transport that actually, when the buses actually turn up and that doesn't cost the earth?
Yeah, so the Green Party have pledged to take the national road building budget of £6 billion and put it into free public transport for everyone.
So that means not fixing the potholes, does it?
No. So this is the new road building budget rather than the pothole budget.
So what about what changes are people going to see here? Because, I mean, we've got this diesel ban coming in. Is that something you're supporting?
I'm not supporting the diesel ban in 18 months' time. I mean, let's be clear that that's a policy of the current mayor. We need to clean up our air in the city, and the mayor has come up with a slightly odd plan of banning diesels but not other vehicles from the city centre. To my mind, if you're going to reduce our emissions and clean up our air in the city, you need to give people time. So you start to charge people through a clean air zone from next April or May, but slowly ramp up the prices over, say, a 5 or 10 year period. That then allows business
that's
and
individuals. That's basically what's happening in London, isn't it?
Yes, but it is what's happening in London. It works perfectly well in London, and actually a lot of other cities are introducing exactly the same. So for some reason our mayor has gone for this slightly odd approach of banning diesels but not charging other cars, which of course then means if you live in South Bristol you can't get up to the north of the city, or if you wanted to go and visit your gran in hospital. At the moment it's not clear whether you would be allowed to drive through the city centre if you had a diesel car.
So where did this idea come from? It doesn't sound all that logical. I mean, even on national radio, the mayor has been hauled over the coals, saying, well, what happens to a delivery driver? He's not allowed to go into the city centre anymore. If he does, he's going to get a whacking great fine. Things like cabs. That's an obvious one, isn't it? What's going to happen with that?
So my understanding is that cabs would be charged and buses would also be charged, which I find strange.
They are public transport. I don't know if the mayor realises this, but this is all public transport.
Well, so at the moment, the proposal the mayor has put forward is that buses would be charged £100 per day to come through the clean air zone.
So that is just going to go on to fares?
So that's going to go on to fares. And actually, I spoke to somebody the other day who lives outside of Bristol, but they've already had a letter from their bus company for the school bus that they would have to increase their child's ticket fare because if the clean air zone, as the mayor is planning it, goes in. In answer to your question as to why it's happened, I don't know. You'd have to ask the mayor that.
Well, the mayor won't come on here and explain it.
But the mayor has been holding off on a decision. We were supposed to have a plan 2 years ago. We haven't had a plan. It's been delayed until eventually central government said, right, we're going to consider taking you to court if you don't come up with a plan. So what I think is they've made a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, not really thought it through. And I think you'll find that when it goes to central government for comment in the new year, that central government will almost certainly turn it down and will be back to the drawing board.
So Bristol could be the first first city in Britain. I mean, European cities, some of them have done this and quite successfully banned diesel. So why not here?
Yeah, so Amsterdam, for example, is going for a zero-emission city centre prisoners by 2030. So absolutely, we can do it. It's not a bad ambition.
They're banning petrol cars too.
Well, they're banning. We need to go to zero emission and not just pick one form of transport over another. And the second
especially
thing is
the buses.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
Buses have to pay the
tax. Have to pay to get in.
But if it's a petrol driven bus, it doesn't.
Well, that's right. And what you need to do is give people time. You need to give people certainty over a 5-year period. You would increase the prices and then eventually put a ban in place. That gives people time. If you're a business to buy a new vehicle, if you're looking to buy a new vehicle privately, you would do that and look for electric. You can put in electric charging points and improve the buses, improve cycle facilities. And that way the transition happens in a planned way, not a knee-jerk way that means in 18 months' time, if you bought a diesel car a month ago, you're suddenly not going to be able to drive it through the city centre or visit your gran in hospital.
Whilst we're still talking about what's going to be happening here in Bristol, and you are the mayor candidate next May, mm-hmm. That people can vote for if they wish, the People's Republic of Stokes Croft and various others have put together something called the Respect and Dignity Commitments. Now, I'm going to completely spring this on you,
yeah.
But it'd be really interesting to see what of these commitments to do with things like public art, homelessness and that kind of thing that you could sign up to. So,
okay.
First of all, providing sizable free community-curated public street art space in or adjacent to Stokes Croft or to showcase local artists. And I think the main idea of this is rather than just having people kind of graffitiing everywhere, a specific place where people say, go and do some graffiti there, please, rather than any old way and on my house.
Yeah, and absolutely, I would support that. In my day job as Creative Youth Network, we are getting young artists out and about, putting their work out across the city.
Graffitiing?
Yes, absolutely. But it's good graffiti, so it's art, it's not just tagging. And so we have done that in the Bear Pit.
And do you do that in agreement with people?
Yeah, of course you do. You get agreement with people. So we had an exhibition a couple of years ago down in the Bear Pit where young people put across their views and their stories through art. So I'm absolutely in support of that.
Not to criminalise, number two, is not to criminalise the homeless using injunctions unless they pose any kind of provable threat or danger to those around them. Because there's thoughts about saying, you know, there should be injunctions to keep homeless people, all homeless people, out of particular parts of the city.
Yeah, so I come from a point of view where you look at behaviour, not at somebody's circumstance. So again, my, you know, being running a large youth work charity, we look at what the behaviour is and we try to talk to people about that. So if somebody is behaving badly in whatever way, then absolutely you need an injunction. But just because they are homeless doesn't mean that there should be, that means there shouldn't be an injunction. Does that make sense if I explain myself?
Just about.
Yeah.
And also to provide a safe, suitable and drug use free living space for everyone in Bristol, whatever that means. Now that's a bit of a tall order, isn't it? Making sure everyone's got a roof over their head of some sort.
Yeah, and it is a tall order and we will come up with plans. We're just finalising our manifesto for next year's election now, and obviously it's something that is going to take time. The Conservative government have forced councils to cut back on house building and council house building and on essential services that help keep people in their homes. So this is not something you can click your fingers and on the 8th of May, if I was elected, that we can suddenly sort out. It's going to take time, but absolutely, of course, we would agree with giving everybody a roof over their head.
To provide a choice of new suitable transit sites on unused land for caravans and vehicles close to the Bristol city centre. I think one of the beefs kind of written into that is that the only official transit site that Bristol City Council manages out at Avonmouth, next to the sewage works and right next to this new waste incinerator.
Right,
not where I would personally choose to live. I don't know about you, Sandy.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't certainly. I did a tour of it the other day, and I certainly wouldn't choose to live next to some of those factories. So again, yes, we already provide one in my day job. So we were approached by a group of travel who runs a site for travelling circus folk who come and go. They were on an old derelict site that was about to be developed in St Paul's. They came to us, and we've given them a space. It's actually especially up in Kingswood. So we provide space
for
up to
50. When you say we, what do you mean?
So I mean our charity, Creative Youth Network. So, but they approached us because we own a couple of buildings. We own a building up in Kingswood with some land, and they approached us and said, could we do it? And so we now house 15 caravans up there that come and go. So yes, I mean, we don't need to identify the right site, and you have to provide, the important thing is there has to be running water and toilet facilities and that kind of thing on there. So I think some people think, oh, just open up X derelict site and allow people on there. It needs to be hygienic, it needs to be safe, but as long as we can provide those sites, then yes, on a temporary basis until they're developed, absolutely, I think that's a good idea.
Finally, this is definitely not just about the homeless or whatever, it's reopening public toilets. I mean, particularly elderly people, if they're around about in the town centre, some people, they're actually worried to go out because they know that there's nowhere they can go if they need to.
Do you know what I think? I'm not an expert on this, and I hear different people talking about it from different points of view. I think that the current mayor has put in a reasonable plan to try and get public toilets available through shops and through cafes and that kind of thing. I think when you're given a choice, if there is an infinite amount of money or much more money, then absolutely, of course, we would open public toilets. I think there's always a danger that you say, okay, we've got to open a public toilet at a cost of 50,000, 100,000, whatever it costs
sounds
a year.
So what would
we take away? And I think we just need to be a bit pragmatic. Your listeners need to be a bit pragmatic about that. So do we keep a toilet open and not have a youth worker or not have a care worker for an older person? If there is enough money to do both, absolutely. But I would put some of those other services, those more high end services, above the need to keep toilets
there
open.
There is enough money to do both, not for Bristol City Council, and the reason that you haven't got it is because it's slowly being taken away, isn't it, by the Tories?
Well, yeah, so I mean the austerity, the Conservative government have pulled
most of
back
it,
about
most for, of it, I'm suggesting is it probably an offshore account somewhere of rather wealthy people.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but I mean what we're talking about is the tax take by central government, which they have then reduced the amount that they give out to local authorities by about 40% over the last 10 years. So, therefore, local authorities have been forced to cut a range of services, of which toilets might be one.
Now, this week, Martin, we've seen again the Labour anti-Semitism scandal rearing its ugly head with the Jewish Voice for Labour, I believe it is.
No? Probably not. You mean the Jewish Labour movement.
Oh, right. So you've got two rival groups. We haven't heard much from the Jewish Voice for Labour. In fact, last week they issued a statement condemning, or rather using polite language, Ephraim Mervis, the chief rabbi's statement against Corbyn. But the Jewish Labour movement, those are the right ones, are they? I was actually saying they've submitted a whole dossier of evidence that Corbyn himself has personally been interfering in these Labour anti-Semitism claims, even though he's saying publicly that they're all independent.
Well, I mean, as you say, there are two separate groups there. The Jewish Voice for Labour was set up, in a sense, to counter the Jewish Labour movement, who are basically, fundamentally, pro-Israeli, whereas Jewish Voice for Labour are not. And the woman who set it up, Naomi, somebody who's forgotten her second name, she came to speak at a meeting organised by Palestine Solidarity here in Bristol about a year ago. And she said, I'm a doctor in a hospital in London, and of course I want to campaign for the Labour Party and for the NHS. And I'm not particularly bothered about identifying as a Jew, but if there are people out there going to say that they speak for Jews, that's why I've set up Jewish Voice for Labour, so that we can speak out against what is being said. And as you saw last week, the chief rabbi in this country issued this statement. Of course, he doesn't represent all Orthodox Jews, in fact. I mean, as you can imagine, the Jewish community is quite varied in its views. But of course, the European Jewish network or whatever it was completely repudiated what he'd said. So, I mean, there's a struggle going on within the Jewish community about all of this. It's not just the Jewish community versus the Labour Party. And of course, lots of these people used to be workers for the Labour Party. And there's some of them were involved in the Al Jazeera sting, where they were actually caught on camera talking to people from the Israeli embassy about how to get rid of Corbyn, change the policy of the Labour Party. And they were then picked up by the Panorama team and presented as if they were genuinely independent people who were independently coming to this conclusion about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, when in actual fact they'd been colluding with the Israeli embassy, and the Mossad agent in the film said, we've got £1 million to spend to try and and steer the Labour Party in a certain direction. Extraordinary that's out in the open. It's been out in the open for quite a long time, but the mainstream media don't even talk about
they
it.
They wanted to take out Alan Duncan.
They also said they want to take out Alan Duncan, who was a Tory Foreign Office Minister.
Anyway, it wasn't just Jeremy Corbyn that was coming in for anti-Semitism claims this week. It was also Nigel Farage being interviewed by Nikki Campbell on Five Live.
These are quotes that have been attributed to you. The globalists have wanted to have some form of conflict with Russia as an argument for us all to surrender our national sovereignty, give it up to a higher global level. Also, the EU is a prototype for a new world order. And another one, the banking system and politics became hand in glove, one and the same thing. Now, if you said those things, and it's widely reported that you did, those are all, people will say, anti-Semitic tropes. If Mr. Corbyn had said any of those, he would be absolutely hammered in the mainstream media for being anti-Semitic. You said those, did you?
The European Union is seen as a prototype by many.
New world order is the key phrase.
Yeah,
that is a well-known anti-Semitic trope.
Nothing to do with the Jewish religion whatsoever.
It's a well-known anti-Semitic trope.
Not that I've ever heard. What I can tell you is this. Hillary Clinton, when she was running to be president 3 years ago, said to a group in Wall Street that if she won the election, that America would join up with a hemispheric European common market. So what you see is a move towards governance at a bigger global level.
That's not an anti-Semitic trope.
Absolutely not, in any way at all.
What she said isn't.
Well, what she talked about was the emergence of a new way of the world ordering itself. There's nothing to do with anti-Semitism whatsoever.
Phraseology is well known.
Well, I'm sorry. I have never had anything to do with anti-Semitism whatsoever.
Well, I find myself strangely in agreement with Nigel Farage. I mean, the phrase New World Order was originally used many times. It was used by George Bush Sr. after the first Gulf War. And if certain phrases are supposed to be anti-Semitic tropes, then we're getting into a ridiculous situation where people can't even talk about things like international politics without being accused of anti-Semitism.
What Nikki Campbell seems to be hinting at there is that both Hillary Clinton and George Bush Sr., you're saying there, were anti-Semites.
Well, I think what's going on, this has got, frankly, quite ridiculous. If you're going to talk about international relations and the relationships, for example, between the US and the European Union, which, of course, we have the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which didn't come to fruition, but, of course, that's definitely out there. And, of course, Farage and his chums are actually quite in favour of the US imposing on the Europeans. So in actual fact, he's incoherent. But the idea that we can't use certain phrases because some people think they're anti-Semitic. I mean, the banking system is run by bankers. They are evil and many of them are criminal. A lot of what goes on and what happened in 2008 was definitely fraud. Some of those bankers are Jewish. Lots of them are not. And if you criticise the bankers, that's not criticising Jews as Jews, that's criticising bankers. And we can name the bankers J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon, Rothschild, he is Jewish. You understand me, of the Rothschild family. So in other words, this is actually a way of trying to close down serious debate about serious issues, because it's ultimately about the state of Israel. This definition of anti-Semitism, which has been accepted by the Labour Party, shouldn't have been accepted. It's not accepted around the world.
Why not?
Because around the world, it's not actually. The people who wrote it said it shouldn't be interpreted in this way.
In what way?
They say that anybody who criticises the state of Israel's existence is an anti-Semite. Well, that'd be news to Ernie Bevin, the foreign secretary in this country in 1948, who was opposed to the recognition of the state of Israel, just as we're opposed to Serbia taking over Kosovo. That's politics.
Here. What do you make of this row, particularly with Jeremy Corbyn and anti-Semitism? Is he a racist?
I've got no idea. I've met him a couple of times. He mentioned Israel, but he didn't say anything terrible about the Jewish people. I suppose my concern is that the row seems to keep rolling on, and I also see a number of his MPs have resigned as a result of what they say is anti-Semitic harassment. So I can't tell you the details, but what I see is the sort of symptoms of it, which worry me a bit. And the fact that it isn't going away feels to me that it's more than just a conspiracy theory of a particular group of people who might be trying to take out Jeremy Corbyn. But it is interesting, you listen to Nigel Farage's point there. A lot of quite extreme groups use sort of conspiracy theories about the sort of super state or, you know, the New World Order or whatever to justify their quite extreme views.
Well, because Angela Merkel has talked about a United States of Europe, for example. I mean, I think Macron said something about this recently.
But that's the point. It's open, so she's talked about it, and therefore it's open. It's not a conspiracy theory that's hidden. That's potentially what she would like, and she has every right to her view. I think there's a danger when you start to use unstated things to justify, in Nigel Farage's case, a free marketeer, you know, sort of Singapore on Thames tax haven that is, I think, what his very hard end of the right would like. And I think we need to be a little bit careful. And that path of moderation, of which the European Union, I think, is part, it's not perfect, but it stands up to the might of the US. It stands up to the might of the big global companies and allows us, you know, to take on Google and the others who are shuffling tax around the world in order to avoid paying their due to this country and others.
About time too, yeah. I would say. But anyway, Singapore's actually quite successful, isn't it? And quite left-wing. Public transport's fantastic, by the way.
Yes, it is. So, but they also have a very low tax base, and because they have it's a very different economy with a very small number of people and a very high turnover.
People in a small space. And the other thing is they've got incredible public housing. I did a little tour when I was there a couple of years ago, and I was shocked to see. I mean, there's very, very little homelessness, and the housing is all integrated. So the tendency, obviously, is for people to go into sort of ghettos and Chinese communities.
So when I use Singapore in terms, what I mean is their tax rates.
Yeah, there's certainly, it's quite expensive to buy your car tax. I think it's about £20,000 to get car tax over there.
Okay.
Would you like to see that sort of thing? Is that feasible to do over here? Really expensive car taxes?
I think we need to value the environment. At the moment, our environment is seen as a free commodity. The air we breathe, the water we drink, the pleasure that we get from trees and the countryside, and even from our own health, is seen as a free commodity that we can take and use up and pollute. So I think we need to begin taxing much more fossil fuels and other damaging activities, which may be in the form of tax or it may be in the form of levies or whatever, and that way we start to discourage use. And a really good example is the plastic bag tax, the 5p tax on a plastic bag. Lo and behold, plastic bag use has dropped by sort of 80% for a matter of 5p. It's changed our behaviour in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I'll tell you how, what, because you see people coming out of supermarkets dropping stuff everywhere because they can't hold it all in their
Either that or I've got more tote bags in my house than... yeah, maybe I used to have plastic bags, but they're all sustainable and we will keep using them.
Okay, yeah. So on climate change, while we're sort of talking about that kind of thing, Farage also was accused of being a climate denier on Five Live by Nikki Campbell. Let's see what Sandy makes of that.
You're reported as having said climate change is a scam on the Alex Jones InfoWars.
No, he may well have said that.
So you don't think
he
it's
may
a
well
scam.
Have said that? I don't know any more than you do. Right. I don't know.
The 98% of consensual of scientists is that this is
what I do know is the world faces all sorts of problems with pollution, plastic in oceans. There are many other problems too. We should be talking about.
It's classic Farage, isn't it? And I've seen him speak elsewhere as well, where effectively what he does is diverts from the problem. So in the clip you just played, climate change might be a problem, but there's a load of other problems. He's talking
about pollution. That's part of climate change.
But then the other thing I've seen him speak about is he says, well, Britain only puts out 2% of carbon emissions. It's everybody else's fault. It's the Chinese. It's the Americans.
It's
true. But what that doesn't do is acknowledge our historical debt, carbon debt, as the first industrialized country, and nor does it see the opportunity for us as a country to lead the way, for example, as a city in Bristol, or as a country, to lead the way in reducing carbon emissions and show the rest of the world how it can be done.
But it doesn't make any difference, does it? We're still going to get all that carbon and all those noxious gases floating around from China, aren't we?
Well, they don't float as much. I mean, but you know, into the UK, they get dispersed, etc. And yes, the rest of the world produces a whole lot more carbon than the UK.
Say from Avonmouth, because that's a bit closer, isn't it? And a bit just down.
Yeah, so we do. So therefore, if we start to lead the way and look at technologies and different ways of living, I think the funny thing is, lots of people see reduction in carbon emissions or reduction in pollution as a sort of burden to be borne, right? So this is an extra thing we've got to think about. It's going to make our lives worse. But actually, if you look at, say, improving public transport, which is, of course, good for the environment, it's actually really good for equality within a city. Because if you have a better public transport system, those who are poorest can reach the jobs, the education that they need, that they otherwise may not be able to in places like Hartcliffe or Lawrence West, or even Avonmouth. So actually, there are benefits. There are benefits to our community. If we reduced our car use, actually our streets would be for people, for communities. You'd feel safe. Your children would be safe playing outside. You'd meet your neighbour.
Like the 1960s, wouldn't it? I don't know if you. I can remember you used to go out the front door in the 1960s, and you're lucky if there was one car parked anywhere down the street.
Well, I can't speak for the 60s because I wasn't born then. But yes, there are some things that we have lost because we have become so dependent on the car that we will regain as a result of aiming to reduce our carbon emissions. So I think that, and you look at cities like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, which are far more pleasant places to be. People are fitter because they cycle and walk more. Their mental health is better. And in fact, there's a good example of Waltham Forest on the edge of London, which had went through a pedestrianisation process, and a number of things happened. So people started walking and cycling more. The life expectancy went up by 7 months over a 10-year period. Businesses improve their take by about 10% because people linger on the street, and they'll, instead of just rushing into a shop from their car, they'll linger on the street, they'll buy what they want, and then they'll go to a cafe. So, you know, there are benefits to be had from carbon reduction, and I think we don't talk about that enough.
Well, Cribbs Causeway would become like a desert, wouldn't it?
Good.
The NHS, you're talking about life expectancy there. Britain's life expectancy figures have just, the last figures out showed the first downturn for a very long time. And Donald Trump, the question is, Martin, is he going to be, is the NHS on the table? Boris says it isn't.
Well, I mean, the documents that Jeremy Corbyn produced this week show that they have been discussing it in the past. And therefore, they were on the table. And since Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage are well, not Nigel Farage, Donald Trump are well known for saying one thing and doing another, you can't take anything they say seriously. And it certainly would have been on the table in the trade and investment, the transatlantic trade investment partnership. And what will happen point?
I mean, all the politicians do this, don't they? Jeremy Corbyn said he was going to honour the referendum.
Some do more than others. It's not the idea that they all. Lie is not quite true.
Okay, well let's hear from Donald Trump now anyway, Martin. He's arrived for a NATO summit and he got quizzed about the NHS instead.
I'll stay out of the election. You know that I was a fan of Brexit, but I stay out of it. I think Boris is very capable and I think he'll do a good job.
An endorsement he didn't really want, but was safely out of the room.
Should the National Health Service be on the table in trade?
No, not at all. I have nothing to do with it. Never even thought about it. We have absolutely nothing to do with it. And we wouldn't want to. If you handed it to us on a silver platter, we want nothing to do with it.
He said he had no idea where it all came from. But this was President Trump speaking here in June.
Look, I think everything with a trade deal is on the table. When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else, or a lot more than that. But everything will be on the table, absolutely.
That's Donald Trump chatting about the NHS being on the table, about trade talks, and then forgetting about it, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, of course, if he takes NHS off the table, then something else has to come on the table.
But isn't
it
just...
we'll have to make more concessions on the car industry.
Donald Trump is so busy running America that he can't remember what he said last time he was over here.
Well, both he and Boris Johnson openly say one thing one day and another thing the next day. And some people seem to like it, but I don't, I'm afraid.
What do you make of the health service and what's going to happen with that after this general election, Sandy? A lot of people are quite nervous that it's actually on the brink. I think, wasn't it this week, we heard for the first time, or maybe 10 days ago, that doctors were no longer going to be able to do house calls. I mean, this is something that's been going since the 1940s in the health service.
Yeah.
And they're saying, finally, no, the doctor cannot come to you. You've got to crawl, even if you're sick, to them.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Tories have cut the NHS, and whilst they say they've put more money in, they've put less money in real terms, in inflationary terms, than was needed just to cope with inflation, let alone the increasing costs of healthcare due to our population and you know, new technology coming on. So I would agree with Martin. I think there's a strange thing in politics, particularly on the right with Trump and Boris, that people, they seem to be able to feel that they can say one thing on one day and say another thing on another day, and assume that people's memories are so short that they will forget what was said before remember what was said today.
Well, to be fair, I mean, it's not often that journalists, Gary Gibbon doing it just there on Channel 4 News, actually dig out the old quotes and show you just what hypocrites they are.
Yeah, well, although you just need to look on Twitter and various other social media, and you'll see that the lies are being called out again and again. The thing I find strange, and that I can't fathom, is that people seem to believe it anyway, and that's what I really struggle with. I don't know why, but we're in a slightly different political era.
I'm not sure they do. I think sometimes people just think, well, most of what they say is rubbish, they're only saying it to get elected, and once they're elected they'll do what they want.
And how sad is that? Because the cynicism, I do think both, I'm afraid, leaders, both Boris and Jeremy Corbyn, are not well liked, but people are deciding with sort of, you know, a sense of I don't really want to do this, but I'll either vote for Boris or I'll vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And this is the problem with our first-past-the-post voting system. The reason both parties are going up in the polls is because most people go, gosh, if I voted for Green or Lib Dem or anybody else, it would be a wasted vote. And what a shame that is. When I'm on the doorstep talking, campaigning in Bristol West for Carla Denyer, who's our Green candidate there, lots of people say, we would love to vote for you. We love what the Green Party says. We think you'd be really radical, but we feel it's a wasted vote. And we're going to let the Tories in, which, of course, by the way, in Bristol West is not the case. I just want to put that in there as my little thing. The Tories cannot win in Bristol West. So you can vote with your conscience. If you want to vote Green, you can vote Green, and we could put a second MP into Parliament.
I mean, that was from Channel 4 News, but what about the local media? They're obviously really important when it comes to next May's election.
Mm.
Do you think that they're doing their job well enough?
I think they're under-resourced.
Oh, our job, I suppose.
Your
we should
job, yeah, you are part of the local media. They're relatively balanced, and I don't think we have the same sort of extreme conversations that seem to happen at a national level. What I do wish is that there was more in-depth research around what any of the of us as politicians are saying, because I think what tends to happen is, you know, the current mayor's press release is printed, then our press release is printed, and there's not a fact check on either side, actually. So I would like to see more of that, and I do like what the BBC, for example, are doing and trying to fact check various people's, you know, claims and quotes and all that kind of thing. And I think if we could try to do that more locally, that would be good.
You know what we need to do? You need to do it in real time as well, because once the headline's gone out there, or once it's been said on the radio, they need to be pulled up straight away. The trouble is, of course, there's just very little money for this sort of thing. We've got a few local democracy reporters, but other than that, not a lot. So anyway, it's time for you to go. Where are you off to?
So I'll tell you where I'm off to. I'm off to a really exciting thing. So this is from my day job with Creative Youth Network. We have had a group of young people from the favelas in Brazil who set up their own fashion company as a way of trying to get out of the position they were in. They've become so successful that they're now launching it in the UK. They've chosen to come to Bristol. So I'm off to Cabot Circus, where they've been working with a group of young people that we're working with, and they're launching it tonight at 7 o'clock. o'clock, so I need to get going.
I'm going to make you late because I'm going to ask you one more question,
which is
about the Bristol hitting the national news this week. A takeaway owner calling the police as Cottam School teachers were blocking pupils from going into a shop outside the school. Now, I mean, this is what kids do when they go home. I used to do it when I was a kid on the way home from school. You pop into a shop, you might buy something, but the teachers are saying, no, you're not allowed to.
Do you know what? I don't know the details of that story. I haven't heard it before, so I'm afraid I'm going to duck the question and read it, and then I can come back another time and answer it.
Duck out. All right. Martin, anyway, what do you make of this? Cottam School, we've been talking about them in relation to the Stoke Lodge, for example, in the past, putting up fences around this open field, and lots of people who live around that part of the city not happy. But now they've hit the headlines nationally with their teachers in yellow jackets blocking pupils from going into shops on the way home, and actually standing in front of the shops. On one occasion, the owner says actually going into the shop and telling the pupils to leave the shop.
Well, as Sandy's just said, I don't know what the detail of this is. You'd probably have to ask the...
Well, I just told you.
Well, I know, but I mean, the Cottam School will have their reasons for not wanting the kids to go in the shop. Whether they can enforce that in a free society is another matter. I just don't know what to say about that.
Well, the takeaway owner called the police on these teachers in yellow jackets as Cottam School teachers were blocking pupils from going in. You've got two senior teachers in high-vis jackets standing outside a shop like bouncers, apparently.
Well, I mean, what we used to do when I was their age is we used to take our dinner money, which we used to spend, which we'd been given by our parents, and instead of giving it to the school for the dinners, we used to keep it and then bunk out of school and it's at lunch time to go and buy chips, which were not really healthy. But on the other hand, we shouldn't have actually left the premises. Yeah, so we were breaking school rules by leaving the premises during school hours.
God, that sounds like a concentration camp.
No, it's not. I work in schools at the moment, Tony.
Certainly in our school, you could leave the premises.
In many schools, don't forget, the school is in loco parentis, and if children are leaving the premises, you don't know where they are or what they're doing, and they could be getting into all kinds of problems, and the teachers will be held legally responsible if they fall down a mine shaft
whatever. There's certainly no mine shafts to fall down.
Well, I'm just saying that's just an example, but something could happen to them.
We used to go to the park, basically.
Well, yeah, but I mean, some schools do have a rule, and that was the rule in my school back in the day, that you didn't leave the premises.
This is on the way home, anyway.
Then there is an issue. I mean, obviously, the takeaway owners losing custom there are not very happy about it.
Okay, so
these issues have to be,
back to the NHS, much more interesting. And the Great NHS Heist. This is a new film out by Dr. Bob Gill and some of his colleagues. We had an interview with him on Dialect, and he was on this show a few weeks ago. And let's have a listen to that. It's just out this week. Here's a clip now.
The NHS is not for sale, and it never will be.
The privatisation lobby basically gets underway under Mrs. Thatcher.
Electricity, water, gas, the mines, the railways.
Even if you only care about efficiency, the National Health Service should be preserved like a jewel.
There's a sphere of influence that is shared across public and private sectors, and the revolving door, of course, swings both ways.
What the big four accounting firms do is really quite deadly.
PFI has transformed our hospitals into away from actually caring for people and into a means of making profit from the public sector.
Our National Health Service, one of Britain's proudest achievements. Lifting burden from the sick, copied across the world and celebrated in our Olympic ceremony. A complicit media having failed to hold power to account, now busily report NHS failures after years of financial squeeze. Consecutive governments have secretly prepared it for corporate takeover. After years of erosion, the NHS, its budget, and very fabric up for grabs. There will be no share offering, no adverts on the side of a bus. This is a robbery for its new corporate masters in the great NHS heist.
These companies are in the business to make money.
Giant corporations, they get caught in fraud and they pay the ticket and keep on speeding.
They're always vigilant to try to avoid paying for care in one way or another. They were literally kidnapping psychiatric patients and holding them against their will until the day their insurance ran out.
Here in the United States, you might as well be on the moon for the opportunity that you would have to get the care that you need.
No one should ever copy the system.
It is in the sights and the target of the multinational corporations.
Well, obviously, I haven't seen the film that those extracts are from, but I generally agree with the line that seems to be being pursued there. We were talking earlier about, you know, whether the Conservative government wants to privatise the NHS or whether Donald Trump wants to get his hands on it. The many people in the current Tory cabinet, which is obviously not the cabinet anymore because we're in an election, they're on the record. They've written pamphlets saying that the NHS is past its sell-by date. It's got to go. Michael Gove, Dominic Raab. They've written loads and loads of stuff in the past about how the NHS is no good, that they want to have more choice, more private sector intervention. And then they come to an election campaign and they expect us to believe that they don't. That the NHS is not for sale. We should nationalise the drug companies. That's what we should do. We should be extending the NHS principle to the production of drugs. Are the Tory candidates in this election turning round to the drug manufacturer and saying, actually, we're going to nationalise you? Because that's what the Labour is suggesting they're going to do with some key pharmaceutical products. Now that's the real test, isn't it? Not only not privatising the NHS, but actually nationalising the drugs industry.
And what about what was being said there by a woman with an American accent saying, well, the big drug companies, they pay the ticket, but they keep on speeding. This is an interesting concept, which has been going on certainly in banking for a long, long time, is that the idea that they may be taken to court, they may have been producing a dangerous drug which has killed people, is just really just part of the risk assessment that they take. And they may know a drug is dangerous and yet still sell it, knowing that it could kill people until they're taken to court, because they know that the compensation that they have to pay in court is less than the money they would have made
for. Well, the other thing that's very extraordinary is, I mean, there was a Goldman Sachs person at a drug corporation meeting, and he said openly, our business is not making people healthy. Our business is selling them drugs. So we sell them drugs which manage their condition, and then we sell them other drugs to manage the condition that they get into.
See, quite what you could easily get, of course, is side effects of the first drug, and then dealt with another drug.
That's right. And they're not. If we could find a cure for cancer, the drug companies would buy the patent and stick it on the shelf. Because if you cure people, then you don't make money. And that's the whole principle behind the NHS, is it's a wellness service. That's the principle. We want to stop people getting ill, and when they get ill, we want to cure them. Drug companies want to sell drugs. That's why they push vaccines and other stuff. And this is what the system in the US. I mean, in Britain, because we've got an NHS, the drug companies basically the NHS should basically, because it's a monopsony buyer, be in a position to drive the prices down.
We've had an international scandal, since you're talking about vaccines, in Samoa over the last few weeks, of a massive measles outbreak. Now, I believe it was yesterday or this morning, someone who's been campaigning online against compulsory vaccination was actually arrested in Samoa, saying that actually the vaccines are helping cause this epidemic, that people who are getting the vaccines are then getting a version of measles after having had the vaccines. Is that feasible, do you think? What's going on here?
Well, don't forget, the corporations that make vaccines want to push vaccination, because that's how they make their money. The whole purpose of having a nationalised system is that you make the judgment about whether you're going to vaccinate people and on what basis, on medical grounds.
You're talking about having red flags outside the doors of people who haven't been vaccinated, saying, well you please come and vaccinate.
All right, well, listen,
and if you don't this is compulsory.
The argument whether vaccination should be compulsory or not is a separate argument. The point I'm making is whatever you're doing, it should be based entirely on medical criteria and not on profitability criteria. One of the problems.
Should an individual have any say in whether they are vaccinated or not?
Well, one would hope so, but in certain circumstances, for example, if you've got Ebola spreading and you've got a vaccine that might stop it, you might have to say to people, we're going to have to vaccinate you because you're going to spread it.
You hit the nail on the head there in the word might. This vaccine might help you, therefore you have
to. Well, indeed, and the judgment about whether it is that serious that it's got to be compulsory. It should be a medical decision, not a commercial decision.
Okay, well,
that's the important
let's leave
point.
That for the time being. And also this week, when we had last Sunday, the Conservative manifesto was smuggled out in rather a sneaky fashion. The Tories were talking about what was in it on the television before it had actually been put up online. But one of the things it turned out was in there is the criminalisation of gypsies and protecting illegal fox hunting under what's a so-called crackdown on trespass. I'll put a link up to this as well as the NHS film and others on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The idea, apparently, Martin, is to target a tiny part of the population in this way. But some are saying that it's just plain wrong and it appears racist. The Conservatives are being accused of preparing to criminalise gypsies and travellers under racist plans to make trespass illegal. Changes to the law on trespass, which is currently a civil offence, were signalled in the party's general election manifesto, which pledged, "We will tackle unauthorised traveller camps." The document outlines plans to give new police powers to arrest and seize property of vehicles and trespassers who set up unauthorised encampments in order to protect our communities. It could be the biggest crackdown on gypsies and travellers by any government. Now, of course, when they say that the powers to arrest and seize property of vehicles of trespassers, that's their home, isn't it?
Well, that's right, and don't forget the Tory government criminalised squatting in residential property, which has been
Ken Clark, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and that basically used to be a lifeline for many people, which they they just unostentatiously slammed that door, and that's why you find people sleeping in shop doorways, or one of the reasons. But they've always been in the interests of the landowning classes.
Interestingly,
ultimately,
setting themselves against the police here, government last year launched a consultation on unauthorised encampments, including clamping down on trespass. But police chiefs and police and crime commissioners said the lack of sufficient accommodation for gypsies and travellers was the main cause of unauthorised encampments.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got the housing market in this country is a racket, and it allows certain people to make loads of money for doing nothing, and other people sleep in the streets or driven from pillar to post. And, of course, when these people who are mobile or being made to be mobile then lose their votes, then lose their chance of being active citizens, and so it goes on.
A spokeswoman for the National Federation of Gypsy Liaison Groups has said that criminalising trespass would be likely to breach the Human Rights Act and the Equality Act, traumatise children and consume resources on rehousing, supporting families taken off the road. Now, the amazing thing about it, if you sit and think about it, it is staggering, really, that there have been travelling people since the dawn of time. We're now being told this is a crime.
Well, that's right. I mean, if people if certain individuals or groups are being antisocial in what they're doing, well, there's laws against that. But criminalising the activity of being a traveller is clearly wrong. I mean, it's a human right to be able to do what you want. And of course, if there was that we can't house people who don't want to be travellers. There's not enough housing for poor people or people on low incomes as it is. So people who solve that problem by becoming travellers, you're then going to take that option away from them. It's just punitive for the sake of it, isn't it?
Another story, really not, I suppose, connected with the general election, but to do with the Constitution. The royal family, the Queen, apparently, is to retire in 18 months for Charles to become the Prince Regent. That is Faye Brown writing in the Metro. Prince Charles is preparing to take over leadership of the royals when the Queen turns 95, it's been reported. The Queen's oldest son met with his father at Sandringham this week to discuss a continuing fallout from his brother's disastrous TV interview about links to Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Charles's key role in retiring, in big inverted commas, Prince Andrew from public life has fed speculation he's preparing to become Shadow King, which would see him control day-to-day royal affairs while his mother remains monarch. Her Majesty will turn 95 in 18 months, the same age at which her husband, Prince Philip, withdrew from his public duties. There is talk among courtiers that she may use the milestone to allow her son to become Prince Regent.
Well, it may or may not be true. I presume ultimately Prince Charles will become the king because that's, baked into the pie, isn't it?
I mean, does it matter that he may have been involved in the death of Diana too?
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, Tony. He may have been, but if she was probably murdered for other reasons, if she was murdered.
Something to do with landmines, I believe.
Well, yeah, something like that, yeah. It's nothing to do with internal fights in the royal family. If she's been murdered by the deep state, it won't be to do with the royal family.
Just a minute, because Diana was a major embarrassment to the royal family. She was grabbing the headlines making them look rather silly.
Well, I think the suggestion that her landmines campaign was made her a target is probably closer to the mark, Tony. Do we need a royal family? Well, that's a bigger question.
Do we?
I'm not so sure that we do, but that's just something that
society
will have to consider.
So what do we have instead, an elected president like Trump?
No, you could have a figurehead president like they have in Ireland, which doesn't actually do anything very much, but just represents the country.
So what's the point of that?
Well, what's the point of having a monarchy? It doesn't. They don't actually make political decisions, so you could have a figurehead president that didn't make political decisions like the president of Ireland. Why not?
It's been reported also that Charles wants Andrew to permanently retire from his royal role. It comes after it emerged that William was reported to be involved in the decision to sack the Duke of York too. So this is a bit of a feud going on in the royal family. Obviously, this doesn't happen in public. Little leaks come out and there's a bit of discussion about it elsewhere.
And, of course, what it does is it distracts from the underlying story, which is Epstein was probably murdered in prison and was actually, as The Sun pointed out this week, a former Mossad agent said, well, he was working for Mossad. And basically, they were blackmailing the political elite by making sure they had sex with underage girls. And therefore, they can be told that they've got to support Israel's policies, for example, on the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Jordan Valley, and so on.
Or what about on World War III?
Well, World War III is definitely on the horizon, is it not, Tony? Perhaps we could discuss that in this hour or the next hour.
Epstein's, and whilst we're talking about that, Epstein's co-conspirator flees the US hours before the FBI said they were ready to make arrests. This is last weekend.
Yeah.
The woman who allegedly found underage girls for Jeffrey Epstein to abuse has left America just hours before the FBI said it was poised to make several arrests. Adriana Ross, 36, has been accused of lining up teenagers for the convicted sex offender, also said to have known about his friendship with the Duke of York. Last night, as FBI sources said, preparations were being made for several arrests. Ross was seen arriving at Miami's cruise terminal with her husband. The former model was one of four female potential co-conspirators granted immunity when Epstein was jailed in 2008. Ross's decision to leave the country comes just days before the BBC documentary with Prince Andrew's chief accuser is due to air. That aired this week, of course. So this does look as if she's got friends on the inside, Martin, that have warned her to get out of the country.
Well, indeed, they're covering their tracks now. And, of course, we're going on about Prince Andrew, but two people who definitely had dealings with Epstein are Donald Trump and Bill Clinton. And, of course, the point of what he was doing was to try and make sure that everybody who's got any influence in the United States of America and Britain is compromised, so that Mossad can then get what they want in terms of things like the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the annexation of the West Bank, the annexation of the Golan Heights, and so on.
Which, of course,
is all political. It's not anti-Semitism.
It's a major political operation, isn't it? It's a major political operation, this. So what the idea is, lots of rich and powerful people are sucked in here. I mean, actually, Virginia Roberts said was that there's a whole list of these people that she could say, but the people that have been mentioned are, as we've said here, Trump or Prince Andrew. What about all the rest? Are they ever going to come to light? Because it may be that someone may even pay somebody, her potentially, to not mention those names.
Well, exactly. What's happening now? I mean, it's certainly come out. It was originally in Consortium News, but The Sun have picked up on this week, and Mint Press covered it as well, is that Epstein was a Mossad agent. Now, is it anti-Semitic to say somebody was a Mossad agent? It's either true or it's not true. It's a matter of fact, isn't it? And don't try and tell me that Mossad doesn't exist and doesn't do anything.
What evidence have you got for that, then?
The guy who, I've forgotten the name of the guy, Ari something or other, he claims he was a Mossad agent, and he said, basically, Epstein worked for us, and he worked on blackmailing people. It's out there in the open. It was in The Sun newspaper this week, that fount of wisdom and truth-telling.
Apparently, it's in the Saturday edition of the Daily Mail, too, they're saying.
Well, there you are. So, in other words, it's out in the open. Is it anti-Semitic to say that Mossad blackmails people?
Okay.
Because it does.
Well, thanks to our guest, the Green Party's candidate to become Mayor of Bristol next May. That was Sandy Hoare Ruthven, you heard. He had to go off a little bit early, but anyway, join us after the USO and Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
Your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre.